You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, as inter-Euro bickering continues over who should take how many refugees, we'll ask, should some countries take more than others, and how should you decide which ones? Staying on that topic, European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker announces plans for mandatory migrant quotas. So why is everyone still waiting to hear what Angela Merkel thinks? Also, ahead of President Xi Jinping of China's first state visit to the US, we'll ask whether shared interests will overcome mutual suspicions. And remember China's economy. It's still not looking too healthy. So who is worried and who should be? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Stefan Sonning, economics correspondent with Sverige Radio, and Axel Threlfall, editor-at-large with Reuters. Welcome both back to the show. We are going to spend the first half of tonight's programme looking at Europe's migration crisis from a few different angles. The first is probably the most acute, yet the one about which there is the most studied obtuseness, namely the question of where exactly all these people are going to go. With the arguable exception of Germany, every EU's country's answer seems to be somewhere else. But are there some countries who could or should take more than others? Stefan, I'll start with you, and we'll try and consider it from a semi-optimistic point of view. Okay. These are large numbers of people who are mostly young, clearly extremely determined, who have made great sacrifices and taken great risks to seek a better life. Should we be looking at them as at least something of an opportunity?
Yes, I think so. Sweden is a very good example because during the 60s and 70s we had enormous immigration to Sweden, and almost all of them got work in the Swedish factories. Sweden, as you know, were neutral during the war, and all the factories were standing there and just ready to switch on. So we needed loads of immigrants. The Swedish population was far from enough, so we had hundreds of, and hundreds of thousands of immigrants from southern Europe moving to Sweden, and they're all very well integrated now.
Axel, Germany aside, and we will come to them shortly, pretty much every other European country seems to regard them, or to regard these migrants, as a crisis and a menace rather than an opportunity. Is that just political common sense overcoming economic logic?
Yeah, good question. Yes, I think it probably is. I mean, you say you want to put Germany aside for a moment. I just want to pick up on what Stefan was saying. The aging crisis that we're seeing in Europe, Germany is a great example of a decline in the birth rate of the aging population. There was a statistic I read today. What is their population now? 80 million. By 2080, it's going to have fallen to about 60, 65 million. So, you know, on the one hand, there is this huge need for young people in countries like Germany. I think France as well, their population is going to fall. UK slightly different, but we can't really ignore Germany. It's a very good example of a country that has an aging population, declining birth rate. They're going to need these young people.
Stefan, which leads us to the question of how you should decide which countries take the most people. Should we make these decisions on the basis of projections about population growth and decline? Is that actually a useful way to divide these people up?
Absolutely. In the first stage, of course, you have to look at the population projections. And as Germany, Sweden, if I take my own country as an example again, we also have huge problems with the projections of falling population. So we absolutely need it. And Germany needs it. The problem is, of course, when it comes to sharing the burden, to show solidarity. So is the problem, of course, perhaps the countries in the new countries in the East, they would have huge problems to assimilate a lot of immigrants, I think.
Axel, is there also a problem whereby, and there may be a logic to this that I'm missing, but I can't see, for example, that if you are going to allocate migrants to different countries based on quotas, I cannot see that the Schengen agreement survives. Because if you decide to allocate certain people to any country within the Schengen zone, you then have to presumably find some sort of way to keep them there, rather than, because you may then allocate people to, say, somewhere like Greece or Portugal or Spain, and they say, well, I don't want to be here, I'm going to Germany.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And in fact, Merkel mentioned that today when she spoke to Parliament. You know, I think fundamentally that is going to be a problem. But we need to work it out before we start looking at arguments like that. Up until now, all the arguments, or a lot of the arguments, have been qualitative. The political arguments, the ethical arguments of this. I like this idea of looking at countries' capacities at the beginning to take in more. We talked about population, other measures of population density, housing, infrastructure, has it got the health system, the education system to support it? You know, let's worry about Schengen once we've actually addressed the problem that we're faced with now.
We already are seeing that in Sweden, because a lot of Syrians, especially, their goal is to go to Germany or Sweden, and a lot of them to Sweden. And that's because we, since a couple of years back, give Syrians unlimited right to stay as soon as they arrive in the country. So you can even see refugees burning their fingertips, so they can't be fingerprinted in the first land of asylum, and continuing to Sweden. And now, today, there was a couple of thousand people walking along the highways of Denmark, and they did absolutely not want to stay even in Denmark. They wanted to Sweden. They carried signs saying, "No Denmark, Sweden." So we already see.
I mean, this is going to be a problem. Let's face it. I mean, we need to sort out who takes who to start with, and the quotas and compulsory quotas, et cetera, et cetera. But what you raise it will, of course, be a big problem down the line.
Well, the European Commission has today, as expected, outlined plans to compel EU states to take 160,000 migrants under a quota system. And this was announced by EC President Jean-Claude Juncker in a perhaps overdue demonstration of leadership by the EU itself, as opposed to the leader of its heftiest member, Chancellor Angela Merkel. She has looked over the last few weeks rather more like Europe's actual president. Axel, first of all, does this, this is possibly a personal hobby horse of mine, for which I'll apologise in advance, but does this demonstrate a certain lack of popular credibility of the EU's institutions? I mean, Jean-Claude Juncker pops up as president of the European Commission. How many citizens of the European Union do you think would know who he was if they fell over him in the street?
Not many, actually. I mean, you read a lot about this man and his characteristics and his partying ways. I should be careful what I say, but a number of people know about that. The average European citizen, no, I don't think so. This was, I think, his first State of the Union today. He went on about an hour and a half. Looking at it, it was pretty impressive. Some of the language he used, responding with humanity and dignity and historical fairness. He clearly thought very, very hard about this speech. But you mentioned Merkel, and Merkel really suddenly has come out of her shell and is being held up as the one to watch. As I said earlier, she spoke to Parliament. She talked about unity. She talked about courage. She talked about leading the way. And one quote I really liked: if Europe fails in this refugee crisis, it betrays the founding principles. This is very strong language from Merkel. And one diplomat said that when Angela Merkel wants something and plays it sensibly, which I guess is what she was doing today, she usually gets it.
Stefan, why do you think it is, though, that the leader of Germany, Angela Merkel, has looked far more like the leader of Europe than the actual president of the European Commission? Is it just because she has the natural authority of an elected leader of a large, powerful nation, whereas Jean-Claude Juncker is the former prime minister of Luxembourg, and nobody knows who he is?
Yeah, and yes, I agree with you, but also that Juncker is head of an organization, an institution that obviously does not work. you had a couple of days ago, you had this summit with the foreign ministers in Luxembourg, I think it was, and it was a diplomatic failure. They couldn't agree on absolutely anything. So, as, of course, you got one leader who heads an organization that in important parts is not working, and then this charismatic leader Angela Merkel. Of course, she is in a much, much stronger position than Mr. Juncker.
Hmm. I mean, is the EU just too large and too unwieldy to respond effectively to a fast-moving crisis? Because its response to this as a body has been shambolic, and one thinks of various other things, the wars in Bosnia and Kosovo in particular, to both of which the EU barely responded and was bailed out by NATO.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, I come back to that Merkel quote, if you know, if they fail in this refugee crisis, they fail in their founding principles. I mean, we've talked about this before. It's very, very difficult for this bloc to work as one. The last time I was here, I was speaking to Steve. There was a great piece by a Reuters journalist who went to a sports festival in Europe, and everyone stood up when the Italian national anthem was sung, the UK national anthem, whatever. And then they did the Ode to Joy, which is the EU's anthem, and everyone sat down. No one knew the words. No one actually knew why it was being sung in the first place. I mean, yeah, it's a problem. It's a massive problem.
I mean, Stefan, do you think that there is something? Because it strikes me that what is going on here is that, and I think it's telling that you see it at a time of crisis, that there is a reversion to the nation state as the default agent of getting things done, and nation states working within cooperation, making up their own alliances as they go along, whereas the EU does look somewhat impotent and redundant, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's true. And you see that in many questions, of course, but it's been especially clear, I think, during this refugee crisis that the EU are returning to the national state rather than to act as the organization it's supposed to be.
I mean, we are about to see, I think, probably an intensification of rows among those nation states as this quota is discussed. Axel, you cannot help but notice, if you have an eye for historical ironies, that the states who are likely to object the most, apart from Britain, which is always a special case in one respect or another, but it's the Eastern European governments. Yep. And these are governments largely composed of people who can remember living on the other side of a fence built to keep them out.
It's a very, very good point. Go back to Juncker.
To keep them in, technically, but the effect was the same.
Exactly. Juncker, to his credit, he took I say to his credit, I think he did a pretty good job today. He took a dig at Hungary for building that frontier fence. But importantly, and this is to your point, Andrew, he reminded former communist Central European member states that the refugees fleeing Soviet repression had been welcomed in Western Europe. And I think it's very telling that he needed today in this 80-minute speech to come out and remind them of that. He was making a very strong point.
Well, we'll close this section of our discussion, or this section of the show today, with a look at Germany. And as we've been discussing, Germany's leadership on this issue has been actually widely praised. And that's come very shortly after their taking charge of the Greek economic mishap was widely condemned, largely by the exact same people now singing Germany's praises. Stefan, is this just a reflection of the fact that you can't wield power of this sort and please everybody all the time? Is it just the natural sort of warp and weft of power and how people react to it?
It's an amazing total makeover of Mrs. Merkel, I must say. And as you say, she turned from the the bad guy or bad woman when it regards to Greece, for example, and now she's the queen or the president of the European Union. It's interesting to see how very quickly the way people look at a person can completely change direction.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see just how fickle those people are, you know, and how quickly their views of her will change. Because again, I come back to Juncker. You know, he said, this is the priority, this crisis. But let's face it, we've got Ukraine, we've got Greece, we've got climate change, we've got all sorts of crises in Europe. And I'm not saying this one's going to go away anytime soon, this migrant crisis. But you know, when it fades somewhat, Merkel might well become the bad person again.
Just staying on that point, I mean, you can read too much into these things, of course, but how spooked do you think Germany was earlier this year by being widely regarded as Europe's bogeyman again? Because a lot of, especially from their more far-gone opponents, a lot of deeply unpleasant and silly things were said about Germany's sort of dominance of Greece, hearkening back to a period in German history that Germany has worked very hard to put behind it.
I think very spooked. The general public, very spooked. My mother's German. I spoke to her about it on a number of occasions. Very spooked is a very worrying thing when your neighbours are saying things as they said. But I think, again, Merkel handled it very well. She's got this very stoic personality, Merkel. She's got a very level head. The way she spoke to the foreign media, the way she spoke to other EU government heads, she handled it well. She was also responsible, I think, for getting them through that.
Yeah, she obviously took on her own finance minister,
right,
Mr. Schäuble, which goes to show that she took
it. Which is no mean feat.
Yeah, she took it very seriously.
And again, I guess at the risk of extrapolating conclusions from a nation's history, is it also possible, you mentioned there, Axel, that Germany was right on the front line the last time there was a fence across Europe and made a policy of welcoming anybody who had the nerve and the courage and the fortune to get across it. Is it that same reflex kicking in this time, do you think?
I think there's a little bit of it. Something else Merkel said today, and I think it's very important, back in the 60s, this whole Gastarbeiter program that they had in Germany, they learned a lot from that. And they are able to go back and see how that works.
They were still very parsimonious about extending citizenship to a lot of Turks and Turkish families who lived in Germany for a long time.
You say they are still?
Yeah, well, they were at one point, certainly.
They were at one point. I don't know the extent to which that has changed now, but I think we need to applaud Germany.
And let's not forget that Angela Merkel is raised in East Germany.
Of course.
Yeah.
I do want to finish on this subject by asking you both about a quote of Merkel's, which, Axel, you raised earlier, where she said, if Europe fails in this refugee crisis, it betrays its founding principles, though it strikes me that you could replace the word refugee with the name of several other crises that Europe has failed at dealing with in the last 20 or 30 years. Is she right, do you think? And also, I guess, a thought from each of you on this, starting with you, Stefan. What would success even look like?
Some sort of deal within the European Union when it comes to the quota, the refugees. Some sort of solution, perhaps following Mr. Juncker's suggestion today. That would constitute a success, I think. But I think it's very, very far away.
I think... As Stefan's saying, success to me would be some more harmony between EU governments. I mean, it's been far from it, and all these crises we've been talking about, more harmony. And when Juncker stands up, people listen to him. He did have something to say today. I think he used some pretty emotive language as well. A little bit of respect for that institution at the end of the day as well.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Stefan Sonning and Axel Threlfall. Coming up next, Mr. Jinping goes to Washington.
There's a new Monocle book weighing in at 400 pages that's packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. It's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty.
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Staffan Sonning and Axel Threlfall. Now, later this month, the leader of the world's largest nation will make his first state visit to the world's largest economy. President Xi Jinping is due to arrive in Seattle on September 22nd and then undertake formal diplomatic niceties in Washington, including a summit with President Barack Obama before making a speech to the United Nations in New York. Now, while China and the US are obviously never short of things to discuss, they always rather give the impression of being unsure quite what to actually say to each other. Axel, first of all, how much does a state visit of this sort still really matter?
I think it's very important, and I think particularly when the Chinese premier is going to the US. You know, we've heard it said many times over the past 6 months that no relationship is going to matter more when it comes to defining the 21st century than the Chinese-US relationship. You know, I did an interview recently with Richard Haass, Council on Foreign Relations, and he expresses a view that a number of people express in the States, that Obama's is not taking a tough enough stance, posture against the Chinese. You know, we talk about the South China Sea as one issue. We talk about hacking and cybercrime as another issue. It's a really, really important state visit, this one, on so many levels.
Staffan, that talk there, and there is a lot of talk in the United States, most loudly from those attempting to be the Republican nominee for president, about the need to get tougher with China. It's not that easy, though, is it? How tough can you actually get with a country which will basically do as it damn well pleases?
Not much. I think it is a lot of huffing and puffing, especially from American presidential hopefuls. Donald Trump said the other week that China is sucking the lifeblood out of the United States and so forth. I think it's a bit overblown. I quite agree with Axel that it's an extremely important relationship. I actually was in Subic Bay in the Philippines 1992, I think, or three, when President Clinton and the then President Jiang Zemin went into this APEC meeting as more or less enemies. And when the meeting was over, they had agreed to exchange state visits. And from there, it's history. But I think also that it's quite important to remember that United States and China are like Siamese twins. They are very dependent on each other. But it's also important to remember that the US is not China's biggest trading partner. It's Europe, which tends to be forgotten in the debate, but hugely important.
Axel, there are, of course, any number of points of contention and dispute between China and the United States, but is at this point, is the rivalry, is it exclusively economic and strategic, or is there still an ideological tone to it? Does China still dream of hoisting the red flag over Macy's? And is America still does America still hope to export democracy to China?
Far be it as an editor at large at Reuters to say anything on that. Look, yeah. Probably somewhere deep down, yes. But I think cooperation between these two nations needs to be replaced by intense strategic competition. And back to Stefan's point, you know, if you can hit China with what it's hitting you with, you know, a little bit of backlash, instill a little bit of fear, you know, as such a big player, then I think you might get somewhere. They're not part of the TPP trade plan. Of course, the US came out. I mean, I don't think it did the U.S. any good, and came out against this whole development China investment bank idea. The U.S. is certainly trying to hit them on certain things. China and its economy and worries over the economy and worries over a hard landing, maybe they're more vulnerable now than they've been in a long time. Maybe now is the time to be doing this.
Well, you mentioned China's economy, which is a subject which will certainly come up one way or another during Xi Jinping's visit. The economy has, of course, been in an advanced state of lurch for the last few months, although for what it may be worth, the Shanghai Exchange was up nearly 2.5% today. The fear, of course, is that China is not enduring a dip on the roller coaster, but is only on the first curve of the helter skelter, which won't be good news probably for the rest of us. Stefan, first of all, you're an economics correspondent. Is it, and this is something we run up against a lot trying to discuss this here on various shows, is it even possible to figure out what state China's economy is actually in? How reliable, if at all, are the figures?
No, it's not. Next question.
Yeah.
No, if you compare the official figures, 7.something%.
It's about 7% first half of this year, yeah.
If you compare it with other indicators like railway transports, like electricity, like bank loans, it doesn't add up. So a lot of people say that it might be half. 3.5-4% something, but we don't know.
At 3.5 and 4% is still something that a fair few European countries would quite happily swap for. But you know, on the subject of the hard landing versus soft landing, Axel, again we're having to take China's word for it. But a GDP that has been going up, according to official figures, by about 10% a year for decades now, and what is unarguable is that it is the greatest exercise in poverty eradication in all of human history. At that level, it is absolutely extraordinary. Wasn't it just always likely to taper off a bit eventually?
You know, this is an economy that accounts for what, 40% of global growth?
Something like that.
Last year, I think it was, you know, 7%, 4%, 3%. I mean, it doesn't actually really matter at the end of the day when you're looking at the extent to which the sort of trade this nation is doing, how reliant we are, the huge appetite this nation has for raw materials, so making everyone else very, very dependent. The Premier came out today and talked about the risks and said, look, there's going to be no hard landing. He said, we're going to do a lot more. The Finance Ministry, the authorities are going to do a lot more to help out. You know, that's
the sort of thing Li Keqiang would say, in fairness. He's not actually going to start telling everybody to stock up on tin goods and shotgun shells.
No, but he is saying they are, the Finance Ministry, are going to start doing very concrete things with more on the infrastructure project side, more on the PPP initiatives, more on fiscal policy, more on the tax side. The markets expect to see some hard evidence pretty soon of this country doing something.
Stefan, is there actually any way at all of figuring out any indicators at all, that is, which tell us how worried we should actually be?
The market reactions, of course, because markets can cause disruption, even if there isn't a clear and present danger. But I think it's one thing is to look at a very, very big problem, the property prices in China. There is an obvious risk that there are a huge property bubble in China. And if that bursts, it will lead to trouble. It might lead to a hard landing in China, and that would not be fun for the rest of us. That's one thing to look at, I think, and it looks shaky. If you travel in China, you can see a lot of high-rises, new high-rises. They're all rented or sold. But no one's living there.
A bit like London.
Yeah. but you know, it's a great point. And I'm glad you raised it. Real estate debt. More and more people are writing about real estate debt, and that this being the real problem, and local governments defaulting on their debts. Local governments, of course, have been bailed out over and over and over again by the central government. The central government now looks as though it's trying to pull that back a little bit. We're going to see local government defaulting.
Well, we will have to leave it there. Axel Throlfall, Staffan Sonning, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for today's Midori House. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Paige Reynolds. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. The next half hour, there'll be music with Monocle's international playlist. At 1900 hours, Daniel Giacopelli is in with the entrepreneurs. At 2200, I'm back with the Monocle Daily, co-hosted from Toronto by our bureau chief there, Thomas Lewis. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time for this edition. It's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.